is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's green and gold and it sits on the shelf of a supermarket near you. But the butter inside of this Aussie-looking packaging is from the United States. It's labelled as such on the back of the packet. So does that matter to you? Is something wrong going on here? Or is that just fair enough in the world of dairy products moving around the world? I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. You can send us a text. So we buy Danish butter, don't we? I think there's even Irish butter on the shelf. Is American butter in a green and gold packet really that bad? You can tell me. When staying with the US, a massive investigation is going to be launched into the four major American meatpacking companies and their market dominance and whether they're artificially raising the price of US beef. Now, Australia's been selling a lot of beef to the United States. We've got a good tariff situation for our country compared to competitors, and they're at a really big shortage. So should we be wary? Could this affect us? We'll talk through all of those details and more with Simon Quilty.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Lorraine sent a text saying, oh my God, what next? Re-butter or anything else, says Lorraine. Well, I don't know how bad this is. You might have to be the judge of this for this green and gold butter that's on the shelves of Woolworths supermarkets under the Hillview brand. It's the cheapest butter they offer. It's their home brand butter, basically. And it's an imported US product. Gillian actually sent me a picture of it saying it's not even yellow. It's a white colour too. So is there something untoward here, or is this the world market at play? You can let us know your thoughts. Send us a text. Ben Bennett is the president of Australian Dairy Farmers. Can join us on the program now. Ben Bennett, welcome back to the Country Hour.
G'day, Warwick. Thank you.
So it's green and gold. It's the cheapest butter on the supermarket shelf at one of the biggest supermarket chain in the country. It's from the United States. Is anything really that bad here?
Well, they're trying to sort of promote themselves as the fresh food people, and getting product from the other side of the planet sort of makes, sort of stretches the rubber band a little bit. And as one of your listeners has rightly said, it hardly even looks like butter. So please explain Woolies, isn't it?
So what's the problem? Is the problem that it's imported, or is it the problem how it's presented?
Oh, I think there needs to be a little bit more genuineness about the product. Like, you know, dairy is a pretty stock stable of our nutritionist intake, and butter is right up there. We put it on toast every morning. Well, a large portion of us do. And if you're sort of going to pull out this sort of white, sort of, it's not opaque, but it's sort of somewhat different, isn't it? It's very different. And I think we want to be genuine about the product that we have, and particularly where it comes from. And you mentioned earlier about Danish and Irish, but at least they own it. They are making it very clear of where they are coming from, as opposed to this other non-sort of creamy white sort of, disappointing, isn't it?
I was going to ask you about that too, because obviously there is an element, and we even get it on our text line, of people who think that, you know, Danish butter is the best butter, right? It's the expensive stuff on the shelf. But you have less of a problem with that because it's unabashedly saying, hey, this is from another country, whereas this product in a green and gold packaging you have more of a problem with. Is that right?
Well, I think the general population's getting sick of all this commentary regarding fake this, fake that. And when it comes down to just to a standard dietary sort of stuff, we'd like it reasonably genuine, particularly on a very large organisation that portrays itself as doing supposedly the right thing, i.e. the fresh food people. You know, we're very virtuous, and look at this stuff. Like, even canola oil is at least dyed or coloured yellow as opposed to what it really looks like. So, you know, they try and cover that up. Well, you know, just buy the real stuff and you can have good old-fashioned yellow creamy butter.
So do you worry about this sort of white butter on the shelves cheapening the attitude to dairy in general?
Oh, it's absolutely cheapening us. But the thing is, I'd like the consumer to be well-informed, and we will stand by the consumer It will live and die by the consumer. But at the moment, it's costing us, Australian farms and Australian workers, their jobs.
And just in regards to this, supermarkets, Woolworths and Coles and Aldi were all behind a dollar milk, which predecessors to you in the role at Australian Dairy Farms fought against for a really long time to try and get some change here. Here's a supermarket with its home brand of butter now importing this product from overseas and putting it in a green and gold package. Do you worry about going to war with supermarkets again over how they're presenting dairy to people?
Well, seed companies not just doing it with butter, it's also doing with cheese. So if you want a cheese sandwich, the only thing that Australia is contributing from one possible supermarket is the grain for the bread. I think the average Aussie, if they're prepared to sort of pay, on a special, I think it's about $2.25 for carbonated sugar. I think paying $2.20 for a nutritionist drink, I think most people, given the choice of, but having clarity of where it's from, who's supplying it, should be just simply a prerequisite for all of our consumption, and particularly our food.
Have you spoken to Woolworths, or have you tried to contact Woolworths over your concerns about their use of imported butter and imported dairy in their home brands? What do they tell you?
Oh, Warwick, I'm but a humble farmer, and our best vehicle is the kindness of you allowing us to use your medium, to be frank, and ensuring the consumers are well aware of where they're placing their hard-earned dollars in relation to keeping Australian farmers and Australian workers.
Would you like to see them explain why they're doing this?
Most definitely. Let's do it in a public forum.
We'll contact them and see if they've got anything to say. In the meantime, Ben Bennett, thanks very much for joining us on The Country Hour.
Thank you, Warwick. Cheers.
Ben Bennett, who is a dairy farmer in southwest Victoria, president of Australian Dairy Farmers, that national lobby group in dairy. A lot of your texts coming in. Naomi Ingleton has sent in a text. Thank you, Naomi. Used to make the best butter. Hi, Warwick. The US butter is obviously lot-fed. No flavour, no substance. It's terrible, says Naomi. Butter maker, former King Valley and Myrtleford butter. I used to think that the best butter. Really interested in your thoughts on that, so thank you for sending that in. Hi, Warwick. We produce the best quality butter and cheeses, etc., in Gippsland, King Island, and quality equal or better than imports. So that's true. I don't think that's the question here. It's the fact that how this is being presented and whether you think that's okay. There is imported butter already on their shelves. So is this something untoward, or are you okay with this? You can send us a text. Chris says we should be buying Australian made wherever possible. Tony from Woodside says, how can it be made home brand if it comes from overseas? Jill says, what a joke. Nothing wrong with our butter. Probably as dodgy as their cheese, loaded with food colouring. And this one says, complaining about butter, at least it's giving soy and almond milk a rest from the usual bagging. Matt says, afternoon was, I did the weekly shop on the weekend, got that butter because it was the cheapest, got home as white and terrible. How can they sell it? I'll always be checking the label from now on, says Matt. You can get the text coming, 0467 842 722. As I say, there's imported butter already on the shelves. Is this any different? Is how it's presented any different? Does it annoy you, or are you okay with this? Let us know, 0467 842 722. We'll stay in America right now with Australian farmers who will be watching closely as the government of the biggest buyer of Aussie beef says it's going to investigate what it is calling collusion in the meat industry. United States President Donald Trump has called for an investigation, saying beef processors are driving up prices through illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation that is jeopardising the nation's food supply. Here's how America's media is reporting that news that happened Saturday morning our time.
President Trump ordering a DOJ investigation into foreign meat packers, accusing them of inflating U.S. beef prices.
President Trump accusing four of the biggest meat packing companies of driving up U.S. beef prices, which hit record highs in August.
Really expensive right now at the grocery store. The president now looking into it. You could say he has beef with this particular industry here by looking into what he's calling illicit collusion, price fixing, and price manipulation against companies that pack America's meat.
Beef is a big part of the freedom in this country, and I always say where there is beef, there is freedom, and that's what I believe.
I agree.
So that's some of the American reporting on what's happening over there at the moment. President Donald Trump has said on social media, I've asked the DOJ, their Department of Justice, to immediately begin an investigation into the meat packing companies who are driving up the price of beef through illicit collusion, price fixing, and price manipulation. We will always protect our American ranchers, and they are being blamed for what is being done by majority foreign-owned meat packers who artificially inflate prices and jeopardize the security of our nation's food supply. Action must be taken immediately to protect consumers, combat illegal monopolies, and ensure these corporations are not acting, not criminally profiting at the expense of the American people. I'm asking the DOJ to act expeditiously. Thank you for the attention, for your attention to this matter. That's from the US President Donald Trump. What does this mean for us? Because Australian producers, farmers, and meat packers, or meat processors as we usually call them on this program, export quite a lot to America at the moment. It's been a very lucrative market to us. Simon Quilty is from Global AgriTrends. He has been looking at some of this. Simon Quilty, welcome to the Country Hour. The president in America to calling illicit collusion, price fixing, and price manipulation from the United States meat packers. What do you make of this?
Really, Warwick, I don't believe that's the case, because reality is that meat processing companies in America have been losing near on $270 per animal since February this year. So if it's collusion, then it's collusion on how to lose money, which doesn't make sense. So no, to me, you know, it's reaching out, looking to blame someone for effectively what are very high retail prices. So what it's a pretty simple equation, Warwick. If you look at the value of beef and in terms of cattle and the price rise that we've seen over the last year, which is 22 to 32%, depending on the month, and you look at what you know, we've seen in terms of retail and wholesale prices, retail's only up 8.3% in that same period. Wholesale's up, you know, probably closer to 17%. So the sums don't add up. There's simply not enough cattle in the system.
President Trump was elected on the basis of, well, partly because grocery prices were going up, and he said he could lower them. Meat prices have continued to go up, so he's looking for someone to blame. He says it's the meat packing companies, but you're saying the data doesn't support that.
No, I mean, the July figures came out on their herd inventory. You know, they started collecting those in the mid-70s, and it's the lowest ever since the mid-70s, came in at 94.2 million. So, Warwick, it's just fundamentals. They've depleted their herd for the last, you know, 3 to 4 years due to very severe drought. So this is just a demand and supply problem.
Let's have a look then at the state of the US meat industry at the moment. Four large companies dominate 85% of beef processing in America. That's part of what the president wants to look at there. But you say all four are currently losing money.
They are, and this isn't the first year this is the case. So let's look at the largest, which is Tyson Foods, Warwick. And last year, in 2024, they lost the equivalent of $587 million Australian. And the year before, they lost $140 million Australian. And this year, they're predicted to lose probably in excess of $600 million Australian. So, you know, what's very clear is that when you simply do not have the supply and you're trying to maintain workers, plus high input costs, Warwick, the sums simply don't add up at the moment for a US beef processor.
So there's four major players. So Tyson's a big one there. Who else is there? Are they American-owned like Tyson, or are they international companies?
No, you've got basically Cargill and Tyson's are the two US companies, and then you've got JBS and National Foods, which are effectively Brazilian-owned. So you've got South America, North America ownership dominating the market. And trust me, if they could make a dollar, they would be. There is no collusion given these enormous losses.
And JBS and Cargill are the two biggest beef processors in Australia as well, two of those four companies, which brings me to really the point I had in contacting you today, Simon Quilty, and that is, if this investigation's going on in the United States, what could happen from it, and what could it mean for Australian meat companies and farmers who are currently supplying that market in a big way?
Look, I think it not a great deal. I think that the fundamentals don't change. I think Australia will move into a rebuild itself next year. We've got Brazil about to move into a rebuild. The USDA released figures only last week, Warwick, talking of a 400,000-ton shortage globally of beef next year. So this problem is to be potentially repeated in other countries as supply gets tighter and tighter and rebuilds occur across three of the major suppliers. So do I see any fundamental changes? No. I see real challenges. But fortunately, each of these processors have deep pockets. They've been here before. They know that this is part of the cattle cycle globally. And Warwick, I just see actually very good pricing for cattle producers across those three countries for the next 2 to 3 years.
So that's interesting, looking at the market conditions with the United States president, who rightly or wrongly has been seen as quite unpredictable for markets. You think with those conditions, Australian farmers are largely insulated from what may be decided across the shores in what has been our biggest market of late?
I think so. And part of that is not just pricing within North America, but the needs of all the other markets, whether it's Japan, Korea, China. They are all reliant upon, you know, Australia, America, and Brazil for supply. And when all three countries are tight, there's only one thing that happens. Prices globally will move higher here.
And last time the president said he wanted to do something about beef prices, you rightly predicted he was going to look towards Argentina. He says he's going to let in more Argentinian beef. Are there things you're watching now as a result of this? Are there more levers you expect the US administration to pull?
I think there is, Warwick. The obvious one is Brazil and dropping the 50% quota or tariff, I should say, going in, that would then make that lean beef for their need for hamburgers much more cost effective. That's from an Australian point of view, one to watch. I really think they're running out of options, though, in terms of finding ways and means and mechanisms to lower prices. Simply, there is too much demand and not enough supply.
Anything else you're watching in markets at the moment, Simon Quilty?
I think, Warwick, just overall, when these situations arise, you've got to look at alternative chicken and pork. And interestingly, they sit today, near on more than half the value of beef in America, but, you know, in other parts of the world. And lamb's the other interesting one that's triple the value of these products. And yet month in, month out, demand continues to be very strong, with market share actually holding or gaining for both beef and lamb, even with pork and chicken as inexpensive as they are. So I think we can thank the millennials. This is truly one of the bonuses out of, I think, Warwick, COVID, and the millennials who learnt to cook at home, who were looking for quality, but affordable quality at home. And I think this is a unique period in which we've seen, you know, the restaurant experience now being had at home. And we have been one of the big beneficiaries of it for both beef and lamb.
And the world's obsessed with protein at the moment, and a lot of diets are focused in that direction. Do you think that's helping?
I think it is. It's quite an extraordinary situation again, where, you know, the size on the plates are getting smaller, but interestingly, the proportion of protein on the plate is getting greater. So overall, I guess there is this desire for that eating experience. When you have it, you want it to be the best. So proportionately, overall servings are getting smaller, but the role of beef and lamb on that plate is it getting slightly larger, and people are willing to pay for quality.
Simon Quilty, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks again for joining us on The Country Hour.
Thanks, Warren.
And Mitch is a big fan, saying, can we have Simon on every day? Always enjoy listening to him. Interesting to have a look at what this means in America and what it could mean for us, since we're selling so much beef there at the moment. Pete says a real story is behind Trump's attack on meat packers is connected to JBS of Brazil. Two brothers there went to jail involving bribing Brazilian politicians. You can actually still watch a Four Corners program on JBS and sort of some of their actions around the world. But Pete says after donating to Trump's campaign, a lot of that stopped at the time. Well, yeah, but he could be looking at how they're operating in America's meat supply chain now, Pete, and that'll be interesting to follow. And what it could mean for Australia's meat industry will be interesting to follow too. JBS, the biggest producer of beef in Australia, well, biggest processor of beef in Australia, and Cargill's the second biggest. And they're both two of the top four in America at the moment. On the butter, a lot of texts coming in at the moment. I wouldn't eat anything from the US. Have you seen the size of those fools? There's one text. Why are you surprised about Woolworths? There's concern they don't care about Australians. They'll exploit us when they can. And Trump, by the way, is a proven blowhard. This is Brian in Venus. Pretty much all American states have a tax as well. You should be looking at that. You get used to imported food coming in. As a farmer, I'm over it. Public are blind. What are governments doing for farmers? They're just as blind to what is being done by buying at the big supermarkets as well. Imports will eventually be 75% on our shelves, says one text here. And there's home brand apricots from South Africa on the shelf too, says another one. Butter from cows fed grass-fed diet is yellow because of the beta-carotene in the grass, whilst butter from grain-fed cows is white because they consume less beta-carotene, says Heather in Albury. Woolworths also has New Zealand butter the same price as the US butter, $7, says another text. And Dan says, I've just looked at the Woolworths app and the Woolworths Essential brand is from New Zealand. Yes, Dan, Hillview, the green and gold brand on Woolworths shelves, is also Woolworths home brand, if you will. And that is the one that is American butter that is white at the moment that the industry has a concern with. They're also not happy about the New Zealand imports, whether it be in the Essential home brand for Woolworths or the one online, or in the Hillview brand for the cheese too. Both of them, New Zealand imports too.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
My name's Richard Jackson. I'm a retired agricultural consultant, now living in Melbourne. Worked in Gippsland and then worked all over Australia. And when I moved to Melbourne, I felt very disconnected from agriculture, because I couldn't hear the ABC Country Hour. Somebody told me about the app, so I hooked into the app and now I can listen to it as often as I like, or listen to the Interstate Country Hour programs on the ABC, and it's just terrific. Got the phone in the pocket with the ABC Country Hour going, and sometimes people stare at me, but nevertheless it keeps me in touch, and I really love that, because I might have retired, but I'm still totally interested in agriculture and what happens. And the Country Hour gives a blend of all sorts of information, good and bad, but it's most important to keep up. And that's what the ABC Country Hour does, thanks to you.
80 years of the Country Hour.
Couple of quick texts before we go to rural news. All American dairy products are very white, as they pretty much all come off a feedlot. Doesn't have that grass-fed taste that we're used to, says Tom. Pete says America's descending into a fascist third world nation. Why are we importing anything from there until they're brought to heel, says Pete in Ballarat, with some strong feelings there. And Rob says, I've tasted the US butter on numerous trips to there. It tastes awful. In fact, it hardly has any taste that you would recognise as butter. plenty of strong thoughts on US butter being on our shelves. If you have any thoughts on if anything should be done about it, or if this is just the cost of being an importing and exporting nation, you can let us know, 0467 842 722. We'll talk about a rain app in just a moment, but right now, Emma Field's back with some rural news. Welcome back, Emma. Good afternoon.
G'day, Warwick. It's nice to be back. Foreign-owned aquaculture company Tassal has suffered another fish kill, this time at its Barramundi farm in the waters off WA's Kimberley coast in the far north. Martin Pritchard from Environs Kimberley says a picture from a whistleblower over the last 5 weeks shows the dead fish, and his group are estimating as much as 130 tonnes of dead fish are now being buried.
And what we're seeing is truckloads of dead barramundi being shipped and then driven to the Broome Tip and disposed of there, and there's tons and tons of dead barramundi that's headed there and being buried there. We heard about this a couple of weeks ago and had it confirmed by various people in the community. We're obviously really concerned because that part of the Buccaneer Archipelago is really special to people. People go out there fishing, they go out there camping. It's really important for traditional owners. So a lot of people are concerned about what's going on there, and they let us know that there was a mass fish kill happening at Combe Bay.
Tassal has confirmed that there was a lower than normal survival rate in the Cone Bay area in October. It's blamed a natural occurring fish species parasite known as blood fluke, which it says is influenced by a lower than usual ocean temperature. A cattle producer is raising the alarm over cattle tick control in New South Wales. He's calling for the state's independent biosecurity commissioner to broaden the consultation as part of her review of the cattle tick program, saying that if ticks are let go, they could end up as far south as Sydney. Dr. Catherine Cliff, who started in the role in September, is holding three meetings across the Northern Rivers this week. Mooloolambah, Kyogle and Gunnelibah, following a request by the New South Wales Agriculture Minister Tara Moriarty to provide advice on the cattle tick program. Tom Cooper from Bunalbo, a region hit hard by the cattle ticks this year, says it's not enough.
The tick department has been scaled back by 25%, I'm led to believe, over the last 12 months even. So it's hopelessly under-resourced. And if it's just let go, well, we're a buffer area here for the rest of New South Wales, and the rest of New South Wales will be heavily impacted by these tick infestations. And it's going to affect the livelihood of a lot of people. The productivity costs of those ticks as they suck the blood from your cows is absolutely enormous.
Let's go up north now, where the Northern Territory's buffalo industry is ending the year on a high, thanks to a sudden surge in demand from Indonesia. At some export yards near Darwin, about 800 head of buffalo are being prepared for export. Dr. Ross Ainsworth from the NT Buffalo Industry Council explains what's driving demand.
And so as the beef price goes up, the buffalo price looks more attractive. They already have Indian buffalo meat, which is pretty low quality, frozen, and that costs about 100,000 rupees, say 10 bucks a kilo in the wet market. And the cattle beef from our Australian cattle, after being fed, costs about 13 bucks a kilo. And these animals here, the meat coming off these animals here goes in between there somewhere.
They sit in the middle.
About 11 bucks, something like that. So they get a fresh product that's much better quality. The Indian buffalo meat is bone out, frozen. That's it. Now these animals, you can make quite a bit of money off all the offal and the byproducts.
And finally, a small property on the northern tablelands of New South Wales is believed to be the only place in the world where a unique and critically endangered yellow shrub grows. Near Armidale, Simon Walkden Brown and his wife Yvonne Langdenberg have a 200-hectare property, which is the only place growing the small green shrubs with heart-shaped leaves and yellow flowers. And Ben Vincent, a senior regional conservation officer with Biodiversity Conservation Trust, says a recent survey is showing positive signs for its future.
we were able to get out and resurvey the existing population and find the mature adults are about the same. So that's great. It means they're persisting well. But the exciting news was to see, I think we counted about over 600. So that's a great outcome. And these guys are, you know, they're probably 20 or 30 centimetres tall. So the point there is that they've been in the landscape now for probably 4 or 5 years and persisting well.
It was believed, like so many other Australian natives, fire was needed to break seed dormancy. But it appears in this case, drought was the catalyst.
Severe drought, like that which we experienced in 2018 and into the end of 2019, appears to also break dormancy. So, you know, the Australian flora is adapted to boom and bust drought situations like we had.
Well, Warwick, that's a benefit of drought I have never heard of. And that wraps up Rural News for this Monday.
Yeah, talk about looking on the bright side. Thanks very much, Emma Field there with Rural News. Hey, some rainfall figures coming in on the text line. One of them has warmed my heart a bit. One from Mick down in Gifford. 60 millimetres here at Gifford over the weekend, 61 for October and 90 so far in November. Things looking a whole lot better now. I know that'd be too late for some crops down that way, Mick, but just lovely to hear that you're getting some rain. So thank you very much for keeping us updated with that. And Jill at Tynong North, we had 51 millimetres at Tynong North Friday night. Saturday, 98 millimetres for the first week of November. We've had enough now, says Jill. Thanks very much for that, Jill. Let's go to the Bureau and find out how much is falling. Oh, well, it's certain locations. And really, if any more is to come for the week, that's what we want from the forecast, to know that kind of detail. Michael Efron can tell you that kind of detail. Senior forecaster at the Bureau. Hi, Michael.
G'day, Warwick.
How are we looking around Victoria this lunchtime? A bit sort of blue sky and fluffy clouds, where I am?
Yeah, so through the north and northeast, through East Gippsland, a few more breaks in that cloud, but in the south and southwest, pretty cloudy conditions with a cold front approaching the southwest coast at the moment. So we have seen some showers starting to move into those southwestern parts, 2 millimetres so far at Cape Otway, 1 at Warrnambool, and we'll see those showers pushing further north and east through the rest of today, but mainly focused near and south of the ranges. In terms of our temperatures today, we are looking at the mid to high teens in the south, low to mid-20s for northern districts. We do have some warnings out across the state. So some flood warnings that have been finalised for the Mitchell, Thompson and Bunyip rivers. Also sheep graziers warning out for most districts as well. Conditions becoming quite chilly as we head into Tuesday. And with that front moving through tonight into Tuesday morning, we will see quite extensive shower activity near and south of the ranges. Some of those showers are pushing north of the divide as well, but in terms of totals in the south for Tuesday, we are looking at around 1 to 10 millimetres for southern parts, but through eastern parts of the central district and then into west and south Gippsland, we're looking at around 10 to 20, maybe even 30 or 40 millimetres in parts. So wetter spots, I think, around Mount Baw-Baw, then into the Yarra Ranges, down towards places like Warragul, Jindavik. So very wet through that area on Tuesday. In the north, totals generally under 5 millimetres. And as I mentioned, very cold. So we are looking at some snowfalls developing potentially as low as 800 metres on Tuesday. So very wintry conditions, some small hail likely through southern areas as well. Winds will be quite fresh from the southwest. And so in terms of our top temperatures for Tuesday, we're looking at around 12 to 16 in the south, 17 to 22 for northern districts. Wednesday and Thursday look reasonably settled across the state, even the chance for some frost patches in the north on Wednesday morning, and then a partly cloudy day expected, a little bit warmer as well. The wind's really easing off. Temperatures around 18 to 24 degrees, 26 for Mildura. Thursday, a little bit warmer once again. Temperatures generally the low to mid-20s in the south, mid to high 20s across the north. And then as we head towards the weekend, on Friday, we'll see a low-pressure system over South Australia starting to push towards Western Victoria. So some showers and thunderstorms developing in the west and the northwest. Prior to that, we'll be quite warm. Temperatures in the mid to high 20s for most areas. the mid to high teens or low 20s in the southwest. And on Saturday, that shower and storm activity pushes across the rest of the state, and we could see some light to moderate falls out of that. Temperatures generally in the low to mid-20s in the south, mid to high 20s for the north. And then on Sunday, the wind's tending cooler southwesterly. Temperatures in the high teens to low 20s in the south and mid-20s for northern districts. But tomorrow looking very cold, temperatures around 5 to 10 degrees below average for November.
Okay, okay. So warnings-wise, next 24 hours or so, Michael?
Yeah, so the sheep graziers warning is the main one there with cold, wet and windy conditions for a lot of areas. In terms of those flood warnings, so they have been finalised.
Okay.
But I would expect that with that rain coming, we may see one or two of those popping back in throughout Tuesday.
Okay. Michael, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks, Warwick.
Michael Efron there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. A couple of texts coming in. Before I actually get to the text too, the GrainCorp update for harvest has just come through. Victoria harvested 24,000 tonnes of grain, well, delivered to GrainCorp last week, taking that total to 45,500 tonnes. So it's another slow week, really, due to, they're saying, wet conditions. But as things cleared up around the Swan Hill and some of the northeast regions, barley in the main was what was coming into storage sites there. One text says, how'd your tennis go? Well, first time on a grass court, I think, in about 18 years. First time playing singles in about a decade. Went as well as you think it did. I got flogged. Thank you very much for reminding of that on the text. Chris from Bendigo says, was recently got back from family holiday in Europe and brought foil-wrapped French butter that I thought was meant to be some of the best in the world. Very underwhelming. Pale, almost white in colour, and flavourless. Chris, sometimes I think we don't know how lucky we are for food here.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
I'll keep moving or I'll get on a high horse. Let's talk rain right now. Farmers looking for a more accurate record of localised rainfall can now use a new app designed to help producers gain greater insight into rainfall information specific to their property. Developed at the Federation University in Ballarat, Rainfall Mapper merges the information from the BOMS rainfall gauges and radar data and allows users to select areas of up to 500 by 500 metres specific locations and time periods to mark their own data. Creator Dr. Peter Weir with the university's e-research and digital innovation unit says the tool will help farmers to make more informed decisions, including crop planning and irrigation strategies.
Traditionally, we measure point-based with rain gauges, so they only represent in the area of rain that they collect is about that of a small dinner plate. By taking this application to merge rainfall with weather radar, we're able to look at a whole area. In this particular case, it's an area of 500 metres by 500 metres. This is already a product that the Bureau of Meteorology have been generating for some time. It's called Rainfields 3, and it's publicly available, but it's very hard to interpret the data. It's 15-minute interval data, and it's stored on the National Computing Infrastructure Database, so it's not user-friendly at all. So what I have done is turned it into a user-friendly product in the form of this Rainfall Mapper app. What it is able to do is give a spatial indication of the rainfall falling in a chosen area, so the user is able to select an area by a rectangle on the app, and the app is then able to, and between two points in time, so the app then is able to go and look up the amount of rainfall that has actually fallen in that square, if you like.
So what are some of the practical benefits for farmers?
Well, it gives them a much better indication of spatial distribution of moisture on their paddock, because they're looking at all the rain that's fallen in that area. There may be some inaccuracies in the type of measurement, but it's certainly a lot more indicative of what's going on. As been reported by a lot of anecdotal evidence, with a lot of the localised intense thunderstorms we have, particularly, or we've experienced in previous years around the Wimmera, they've actually been totally missed by the rain gauges, because the bomb rain gauges are 30 to 50 kilometres apart and the storm cell might only be 30 kilometres across. So in the records that are in the recordings of the gauges just do not indicate what's going on. So what this product is able to do is to infill that rainfall and look at it from a spatial point of view, and that seems to have sparked a lot of interest amongst farmers.
So the Bureau of Meteorology has been under scrutiny, certainly recently, but over a number of years now, farmers are saying that they don't necessarily trust that the information coming out of the Bureau of Meteorology is accurate. So can farmers trust this app?
It has got disclaimers in it that I'm a consumer of the data and not a producer of the data. There are inherent possible inaccuracies in using merged radar and rainfall data. But, of course, it's been approached in a fairly scientific way to generate spatial merged data using selected rain gauges. They don't use all the rain gauges in an area, but that's not my remit. You'd have to speak to the Bureau about that. At the same time, it's very indicative of what's actually happening spatially in the landscape.
If a farmer's interested in searching a certain time period, is that a possibility?
Yes, yes. It depends on the way where the data's been set up. Some of the radars, weather radars, are only around 2 years old, so obviously they can't go back much further than that, but some of them have been around for much longer than that. The data that covers most of the rainfed cropping regions of Australia, something like 70-odd radar units which we can access the data, they can choose from 24 hours. They can look at, say, a whole season's worth of data for a specified area, but there are constraints on the size of the area at that they choose at the moment. You know, you can't choose half the state. The amount of data you create was just impossible.
It's a bit more specific than that.
Yeah, looking at it from a paddock point of view, the use that it's been experienced so far, people have found it extremely helpful and interesting to look at what's happened, how much has been accumulated, say, on the paddock, and whether there are wetter areas than others. And that gives them the impetus to go and maybe do some more investigation to see if that is valid.
And to that point, as the weather patterns change and are less predictable, what role does an app like this play?
The more we get these localised intense thunderstorms, the more useful this becomes, because, as I mentioned before, the gauges are too far apart to pick up the detail. If you think of a rain gauge as roughly the size of a small dinner plate, that's the only area that is actually being measured. If you take all of the Bureau of Meteorology rain gauges that cover the whole of Australia and work out the area of each one of those, it's equivalent to about the area of a tennis court. So it is very much this problem of taking point measurements in a highly chaotic event, because the rainfall is one of the most challenging meteorological variables to measure or model because of its randomness, especially in these localised thunderstorms, which, you know, the data is only really available on the radar, and then merging it with the rain gauge data helps make it more accurate.
That's Dr. Peter Weir, researcher at Federation University Centre for E-Research and Digital Innovation, having a chat with Jane McNaughton. You're listening to The Country Hour. Let's talk some flowers right now before we head to livestock markets. November usually might mean horse races for many of you, maybe hay fever, but it also is the start of lavender harvest as well in areas around Victoria. Anne-Marie Manders has been growing lavender in Victoria's Yarra Valley for the last 35 years. And Faith Tabaluyan stopped by her farm to learn how the tiny purple flower is grown, picked and packed.
It's a pristine spring morning when I visit Anne-Marie Manders, a lavender grower from Wandin in Victoria's Yarra Valley. We're going for a stroll through her rows of purple lavender plants.
The two main lavenders that we do grow on a commercial basis is an intermediate lavender, which has a gorgeous camphoraceous fragrance and is wonderful for keeping moths and silverfish out of your wardrobe. And it flowers and is ready for picking at the end of December into January. The other lavender that we grow is an angustifolia lavender, and that is a lavender that you can use in food products, drinks, teas, ice cream, scones, biscuits, cakes, herb breads, all those sorts of things. Now, with the edible lavender, it is ready for picking at the end of November. So there is a month between when we pick the edible lavender and when we pick the non-edible lavender. Now, that was more a matter of good luck rather than good management in my case, because I knew nothing about what I was doing.
That's because Anne-Marie never dreamed of becoming a farmer. In fact, she had a whole other career as an operating theatre nurse before she and her late husband decided to buy an old cherry orchard. 35 years later, the property now stands as a thriving lavender farm, attracting flower lovers from across Australia and beyond. And here's what Anne-Marie tells them about the harvest process.
Now, when we pick the lavender, it's all picked by hand with a sickle, a small sickle, which is what the strawberry growers use. And it's a curved knife with a very sharp serrated edge. We start very early in the morning, at the latest at 6 a.m. If it's going to be a really, really hot day, we'll start at 5:30. And that's when the lavender has got its strongest fragrance. Having picked it in the bunches are picked by hand, a rubber band is put on the bunch. We then stack all those bunches into big picking bins, and then we transport those bins up into the drying shed, where they are hung upside down to dry. And in amongst it, all that lavender, you've got a bit of stick and a bit of leaf, and there's also some flower dust. Now, you don't want that in your lavender if you're going to be putting it into food, or if you're going to be, if it's craft work, you're going to be putting into little sachets or sleep pillows. So we sift it, and we have a series of three sieves, and we pour the lavender through, and it sits in a big bin, like a rubbish bin, and we shake it around. It's all done by hand. And people say, oh, this could be much, you could automate this and have it on a shaker table. But it doesn't, it's not hands-on. And I'm doing it more like the cottage industry, wanting people to see how it was done in the olden days. And I'm a bit olden day sort of in my approach. And it gives people a wow factor. And then they can put their hands into that stripped lavender, rub it between their hands and smell it. And it is gorgeous.
And so now, Anne-Marie, you've got about 12,000 plants on the farm?
Yes.
And you started with how many?
500.
Did you expect the farm to get so big?
No, I had no idea. I didn't know anything about running a business. I didn't have a tractor. I had no knowledge. And as far as making product, I didn't have a clue. And then I had to learn about how to price it. How was I going to talk to people? Yeah, it started off absolutely at the bottom of the ladder.
And so coming back to harvesting and processing the lavender, so the fragrance and the oils, they're actually contained in the flowers themselves?
Yes, the actual oil is in the base of every little, tiny, weeny little flower head. So if you look at the formation of a flower head, it's got a whole lot of little heads within that big head. And every one of those little heads has got a microscopic sac at the bottom, and that's where the oil is.
Anne-Marie says most of her customers don't know much about lavender, but she's set on changing that.
Some of them want to buy some plants to put in the house as an indoor plant. That's a definite no-no. So that's where I actually teach them that lavender is an outdoor plant. Secondly, it needs full sun, must have full sun. Thirdly, you do not water it. So you treat it almost with neglect. However, you do need to cut it back once a year and cut off those flower stems and trim it down into a neat, tidy bush, and then it goes into a dormancy. Unfortunately, lavender will not grow in the tropics. It's too humid, and people that come from Singapore or Asia, these countries, and want to grow lavender, I say, no, if you want to grow lavender, sell up and come and live in Victoria.
That's Anne-Marie Manders, Yarra Valley lavender grower, speaking with Faith Tavalian. You can actually read and see a whole lot more from that lavender farm. It went up on the weekend. abc.net.au/rural is where you can go and look at that. abc.net.au/rural. Just before we head to markets here on the country, a bit of breaking news. I'm looking at an announcement that's come from Andrew Leigh, who's the Assistant Minister for Productivity, Competition and Treasury. Julie Collins, the Minister for Agriculture. Anne Ali, the Minister for Small Business, saying the government's launching a $2 million grant program for supporting fresh produce suppliers for the Food and Grocery Code Education Program, looking at aiming to help produce, fresh produce suppliers gain the skills they need to stand up to big supermarkets as the Food and Grocery Code becomes mandatory on the 1st of April 2025. I'll try and find out more about that and bring it to you, but I just saw that pop up, thought it was worth a mention. We'll keep an eye on that for you. In the meantime, I'm sure many of you are keeping an eye on the markets. And we better get moving, so let's go to Corowa first. Caroline Ronald is there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, agents penned 15,600 sheep and lambs with 6,580 new season lambs on offer. Prices were stronger with all regular buyers operating. New season trade weight lambs jumped up to $15, light and medium trade 215 to 262, heavy trade 23 to 26 kilos, 257 to 312 to average 1161 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavy lambs gained $7, 314 to 340, extra heavy export types 345 to 372. Restockers and feedlot buyers operated in a dearer market. Light lambs to the paddock 150 to 211, feeder lambs 180 to 245. Mutton trends were mixed, extra heavy merino ewes slipped $7, crossbreds up to $16 softer. Trade sheep gained $5, selling from $150 to $190. I'm Caroline Ronald from MLA at Corowa.
Apologies for the phone line. We got there though. Let's go to Jenny Kelly, who's at Bendigo.
Good afternoon. More numbers this week, but prices still rocked along. Nearly 23,000 lambs, up 7,000. On a carcass basis, good processing lambs were still at averages of $11 to $11.80, with some domestic lambs over $12. Good merino lambs, $10 plus. Export suckers to $385, Shorn lambs to $380, Fred Merinos to $341. The lead run of heavy suckers, $302 to $357. Heavy trades, $266 to $310. Store lambs very strong. Carcass prices matching and exceeding the finished lambs. Trade bodied lambs to the paddock, $230 to $250. Solid mutton sale. Carcass prices tracking 20 cents either side of last week, which kept most ewes at $7 to $7.80. Some light mutton over $8 again. Most trade sheep, $165 to $220. Lightest ewes, $126 to $160. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. Let's go to the cattle now. Leanne Dax is at Wagga.
Good afternoon. This week we've seen a lift in numbers following the uptick in prices. The previous sale, agents have yarded $4,925. Lightweight steers have picked up 20 cents, the 200 to 280 kilo, topping at $628 to average $1,430. The heifer portion are averaging $1,202. Trade steers and heifers are up 10 cents, selling between $436 and $496. Feeder steers lightweight have gained 12 cents, $4.55 to $5.58. The medium weights are firm, $4.36 to $5. Lightweight heifers to feed on have jumped 20 cents to average $4.63. The medium weight feeder heifers are firm, $4.26 to $4.96. Heavy grown steers and bullocks are firm to 10 cents better, $4.30 to $4.96. Heavy cows and the leaner grades are also unchanged. The heavy portion, $3.99 to $4.38. Stock cows, $3.88 to $4.12. Leanne Dax, MLA.
And Chris Agnew's at Mortlake. Chris.
Thanks, Warwick. At Mortlake, numbers rebounded back up to 1,948, an increase of 1,357 on last week's offering. The market was generally firm to slightly dearer in places for bullocks, grown steers and trade cattle. There was continued strong demand for the well-bred feeder steers and heifers. However, the very heavy beef cows came back 20 cents a kilo, but the better medium weights and dairy cows remained firm. Heavy grain bulls remained firm to slightly dearer. Bullocks sold up to a top of 487 cents a kilo. Better quality trade cattle remains between 470 and 538, with the heavy beef cows making between 410 and 440 cents, and dairy cows, particularly those with a better cover, range from 370 to 420 cents. Manufacturing steers reached 446 cents, and the grown heifers making between 400 to 480 cents. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Oh, you got there, Chris. Well done on that. That's it for the Country Hour today. I'll be back with you tomorrow with an international flair, I reckon.